He walked barefoot through Babylon, armed only with truth, drumbeats, and dreadlocks. They called him the Quiet One, but he was never silent. He was the voice of the mystic drum. Bunny Wailer, founder, fighter, father, prophet. From trenched-down zinc fences to the hills of Zion, his journey was not just music, it was message. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean audiobook. If you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss a story. Today, we're honored to bring you Bunny Wailer, A Journey Through Time, Episode 2. Get ready to immerse yourself in a powerful narrative that goes beyond music, into legacy, resistance, and roots. Because here, our mission is simple: to keep our culture alive, one story at a time. Chapter 5, Babylon's Chains. The chains didn't clang like iron, but they were there, cold, tight, silent. Babylon's grip came not just through shackles and police batons, but through the slow tightening of control over mind, body, and spirit. In the 1960s and 70s, Jamaica was boiling over, and Bunny Wailer stood at a crossroad where music, rebellion, and faith all collided. But in 1967, when he was arrested and sentenced to serve 14 months in jail for marijuana possession, the crossroads disappeared. Only walls remained. It wasn't the first time a Rasta was targeted. It was systemic, routine. Dreadlocks alone were enough to be profiled, beaten, or detained. Babylon didn't understand the locks, what they meant, what they symbolized. They saw them as filth, as rebellion, as threat. And in a way, they were right. The marijuana charge, while small on paper, was massive in symbolism. It wasn't about the herb. It was about silencing a voice, stopping a movement before it erupted. And for Bunny, a man so deeply connected to his spiritual rhythm, to be stripped of freedom and confined to a cell was both a punishment and a revelation. Prison in Jamaica during that time was brutal. Overcrowded, unsanitary, violent. You didn't just lose your freedom, you lost your name, your dignity, your sense of time. But Bunny, like so many prophets before him, used confinement not as a tomb, but as a temple. He turned inward, meditated, read, prayed. He studied texts, scriptures, and revolutionary literature that the outside world moved too fast to digest. In the stillness of his cell, something ancient awakened. He began to see the world more clearly. Not just Babylon's oppression, but its psychological traps. How the system weaponized poverty, how it glorified Western ideals, how it branded African heritage as backward and criminal. The very herb they locked him away for, ganja, was a sacrament in his faith. A sacred tool of reasoning, meditation, and cleansing. Yet here he was, surrounded by concrete, locked away for a leaf. It was in those moments of forced stillness that Bunny refined his understanding of what it meant to be not just a musician, but a spiritual warrior. And yet, the pain was real. The betrayal, bitter. Not just from the government, but from the industry he had helped build. Few came to visit. The buzz of the Wailers continued without him, and the bitter taste of being left behind began to settle into his bones. But Bunny didn't let bitterness rot him. He began writing songs inside those prison walls. Songs that came from a place deeper than commercial ambition. Songs born from the belly of Babylon. His thoughts turned not just to freedom, but to the cost of liberation. He understood, more than ever, that freedom wasn't just physical, it was spiritual. And too many of his people were walking around outside those gates, just as imprisoned as he was, shackled by lies, illusions, and indoctrination. He began to see imprisonment not as a detour, but as initiation. When he finally walked out after serving his sentence, the world had shifted. So had he. He was leaner, quieter, but sharper, his eyes clearer than ever. He didn't reemerge as a victim. He reemerged as a prophet tempered by fire. The music industry expected him to fall in line. Smile. Record. Tour. But Bunny had other plans. The streets of Kingston had not gotten quieter in his absence. If anything, the tension had deepened. Political warfare had escalated. Gangs funded by rival parties controlled entire blocks. Youth were being armed and deployed like pawns. The poor were no longer just forgotten. They were being used, weaponized, sacrificed. Bunny returned to this chaos with a kind of spiritual armor. His dreadlocks were longer now, his chants deeper. He was no longer just part of a group. He was a man on a mission. The Wailers had kept moving while he was away, but something had shifted in the dynamic. Bunny could feel it. The music had evolved, yes, but so had the machinery behind it. Bigger contracts, international pressure, creative compromises. Bob was becoming the face, and the industry was beginning to carve the Wailers into a solo act with backing singers, even if they didn't say it out loud. It wasn't just the loss of creative control. It was the loss of spiritual alignment. Bunny had paid the price for staying true to his beliefs, and when he returned, he found a world where authenticity was being traded for access. Reggae was on the verge of becoming a product instead of a prophecy. And so quietly, Bunny began to retreat. Not in anger, not in spite, but in preservation. He understood now that Babylon didn't just lock you in cages. It tried to steal your soul, dilute your message, convince you that resistance was futile. That faith was a costume. That Rasta was just another marketing ploy. But Bunny refused. He refused to conform, refused to entertain, refused to turn revolution into rhythm without reason. In interviews after his release, he rarely spoke of the prison experience in detail. Not because he wanted to forget it, but because he knew it wasn't just his story. It was the story of every youth in Jamaica who had ever been told their spirituality was criminal. Of every Rasta locked up for burning a chalice while politicians snorted imported cocaine in air-conditioned offices. Of every man who dared to question the system and paid for it with silence. When Bunny did speak of it, he did so with poise. "Dem can lock me body," he once said, "but dem sign lock D-word. D-word still fly free." And indeed it did. His voice, once just one harmony in a trio, now carried the weight of prophecy. And while Bob's fame soared and Peter's militancy burned bright, Bunny settled into a new kind of power, an unshakable presence grounded in principle. This chapter in his life, this confrontation with Babylon's justice system, wasn't just about incarceration. It was about initiation, transformation, baptism by fire. He came out not broken, but born again. Not as Neville Livingston, but as Bunny Wailer, the Black Heart Man, the mystic, the last prophet of roots reggae. Chapter 6, Exodus of the Soul. The soul doesn't always leave with ceremony. Sometimes it slips quietly through the back door, weary of the noise, the bright lights, the shifting shadows. For Bunny Wailer, the soul's exodus didn't happen on stage. It happened in silence, in discomfort, in knowing the rhythm had changed, even if the beat stayed the same. By the early 1970s, the Wailers were no longer just a Jamaican act. They were a global phenomenon on the rise. The group's fusion of roots reggae, spiritual philosophy, and street-hardened poetry was penetrating borders, broadcast stations, and souls across oceans. The world was listening, but for Bunny, something wasn't right. There was a dissonance growing louder in his chest. The music was more powerful than ever. Catch a Fire had ignited minds. Burnin' was an anthem for revolution. But backstage, beneath the surface, Bunny saw a spiritual drift. What had started as a mission, three young lions lifting up the truth of Rasta, Garvey, and Roots, was morphing into something he couldn't trust. Bunny felt it in the way the label meetings unfolded, in the way managers negotiated without consulting the whole, in the growing weight of Bob's spotlight, not as a brother, but as the chosen one of Babylon's machine. Not chosen by faith, but by convenience. He saw it in the way the music began to cater, ever so slightly, to foreign ears, lyrics being tweaked, tones softened, rhythms polished. He felt it in the way tour schedules were organized like military campaigns, with little time for grounding, for ceremony, for prayer. He saw how ganja was embraced for its novelty, but Rasta was sidelined for its fire. For Bunny, touring was not just physically taxing, it was spiritually corrosive. He despised the cold climates, the bland food, the cultural distance, and the gawking eyes of white audiences who consumed the music without understanding its marrow. He watched from stage left as dreadlocks became trend, as chanting became spectacle, as revolution was reduced to rhythm. And it broke something inside him. He was a deeply spiritual man, more monk than musician. Being away from Jamaica too long left him feeling unrooted, disoriented. Every time he set foot in a foreign land, he felt his soul pulling back toward the Caribbean soil, where the drumbeat of Nyabingi called to him like a heartbeat from the hills. In 1973, during a tour that included stops across the United Kingdom, Bunny made the decision. He would not go. He would not follow the group on the European leg of the tour. He would not dance for Babylon, not under their lights, not in their stadiums, not when his faith was being diluted to fit set lists. The industry tried to frame it as illness, as scheduling conflict, but the truth was simple. Bunny's spirit refused. He wasn't being difficult. He was being devout. The decision created tension. Not just with management, but with Bob and Peter. They had fought battles together, slept on studio floors, shared meals of saltfish and yam, run from police, written lyrics by candlelight, and now one of them was choosing to step away. But Bunny wasn't stepping away from them. He was stepping toward something deeper. He began to spend more time in nature on the outskirts of Kingston, immersing himself in the teachings of the Nyabingi Order. He studied the Psalms, chanted over the hills at sunrise, and listened to the elders who reminded him that a lion doesn't seek applause when it roars, it simply speaks truth. In those months of spiritual retreat, Bunny wrote. He wrote not for the charts, not for radio, but for redemption. He wrote verses that bled sorrow and strength, lyrics that called to Africa, to Zion, to the displaced, to the forgotten. His pen became an altar. His voice became a drum. He was preparing, not to entertain, but to liberate. Back in the industry, things were shifting fast. Bob Marley and the Wailers had been rebranded. Peter was now on edge, demanding creative control. Bunny was labeled uncooperative, eccentric, even difficult. But none of that mattered to him. Titles were noise. Bunny knew who he was. And he knew what the Wailers had meant, even if others had forgotten. The final straw came quietly. No confrontation. No big blowout. Just a gradual unraveling of something sacred. One day, Bunny simply stopped showing up to rehearsals. Not out of protest, but because he had already left in spirit. He never stopped caring for Bob. Never stopped respecting Peter. But he had come to understand that the path forward, for him, no longer included the band. The road now led inward, toward something purer, toward the source. The official story said Bunny left the group in 1973. But the real story was more complex, more holy. He didn't leave the Wailers. He returned to himself, to his core beliefs, to his calling, to the drumbeat of revolution that needed no tour bus, no contract, no promoter. He began crafting what would become one of reggae's most profound solo statements, Blackheart Man, a record not just of music, but of mysticism, a spiritual thesis, a sonic rebellion, a resurrection. And while the world mourned the loss of the Wailers as a trio, Bunny stood firm. He had not lost anything. He had reclaimed everything. The exodus of the soul wasn't a fall from fame. It was a rise into freedom. Chapter 7, Blackheart Man emerges. The road was quiet. Not in sound, but in attention. When Bunny Wailer stepped away from the towering presence of the Wailers, many thought he'd simply vanish into the mist of obscurity. Another, what if, in the footnotes of Bob Marley's rise. But what they didn't understand, what they never understood, was that Bunny never left the mission. He left the noise. And in the silence that followed, something miraculous happened. Out of exile, Blackheart Man was born. Not like a commercial debut. Not like a launch. More like a spiritual invocation, an album that arrived not with marketing banners but with thunder. Blackheart Man, released in 1976, wasn't just Bunny's first solo record. It was a revelation, a scripture carved in vinyl, a defiant hymn to Rasta, to struggle, to spiritual warfare, to cultural memory. But before the album came to life, Bunny had to descend. Not into darkness, but into solitude. After exiting the Wailers, he returned to the earth, literally. He immersed himself in nature, retreating to the Jamaican hills, walking barefoot along riverbanks, meditating beneath almond trees, listening to the wind like it whispered ancient secrets. He sought no interviews, signed no endorsements. For 2 years, he fasted from the world. What emerged from that silence wasn't just a man, it was a mystic. The Blackheart Man wasn't a stage persona. It wasn't branding. It was real. A term hurled in the ghettos of Jamaica to describe dreadlocked men who walked with spiritual purpose. Seen by Babylon as madmen, criminals, witches. Children were warned, don't go near the Blackheart Man, him eat people. Bunny took that label, the one meant to demonize Rastas, and turned it into a crown. In the studio, surrounded by trusted musicians, some of the very same greats from the Wailers sessions, he crafted the album like a sacred ritual. Every note, every beat, every breath on the record was intentional. The drums weren't just rhythm, they were heartbeat. The guitar riffs weren't just melody, they were incantations. And Bunny's voice? It was more than sound. It was sermon. The title track, Blackheart Man, is a spine-tingling epic, a haunting chant that begins with near whisper and swells into testimony. He doesn't beg the listener to understand. He invites them into the suffering, the fear, the judgment, the pride. In that song, Bunny is all things, the hunted and the hunter, the prophet and the misunderstood. He becomes the embodiment of the Rasta archetype, misread by society, feared by children, watched by police, but spiritually anointed and unwavering in truth. The album is not just reggae, it is revolutionary scripture. Songs like this train tap into themes of transformation, purity, and eternal reward. He sings of a spiritual train, bound for Zion, and makes clear that those on the wrong side of righteousness will not board. The track is minimal in production, but overwhelming in conviction. Bunny is not performing, he is warning. Then there's Fighting Against Conviction, an autobiographical masterpiece that draws directly from his arrest and imprisonment. The system tried to brand him a criminal, but he flips the narrative. In Bunny's eyes, it is Babylon that stands trial, not him. The lyrics drip with scorn, not toward the people, but toward the oppressive machine that eats its own poor. One of the most soul-touching tracks is Dreamland, revisited in full solo maturity. He had recorded it years prior, but here, wrapped in the fullness of his voice, it becomes more than longing. It becomes prophecy. He sings of a land free from corruption, where lions roam and the children know peace. The longing for Africa is no longer metaphor, it's marrow. The album's themes spiral outward. Armageddon invokes the biblical apocalypse, casting Babylon as a doomed regime. Bite Up is a call for resilience, a reminder that endurance is not weakness but strength. Fig Tree retells the parable of false promise, urging listeners to live fruitful, righteous lives. And the production? It's restrained, focused, rich in roots instrumentation. Nyabingi drumming, upright bass lines, reverb-soaked vocals that feel like they echo off stone walls in a monastery. There are no pop hooks here. No compromises. Blackheart Man was not made for Billboard. It was made for Zion. Critics praised the album, but even their words fell short. Because how do you describe a work that doesn't just entertain, but awakens? Bunny didn't tour to promote it like other artists would. He didn't perform for television spots. His presence remained elusive, cloaked in quiet power. He would show up at a spiritual gathering in the hills, chant with a Nyabingi circle, and then vanish again like smoke. But the impact was seismic. Within Rasta circles, Blackheart Man became holy, a rite of passage, a meditation companion, a spiritual lifeline. Across the world, especially in African diasporic communities, the album struck chords of ancestral memory. This wasn't reggae for beaches and beer ads. This was reggae as gospel, reggae as sword, reggae as drumbeat of revolution. And Bunny, he emerged not just as a solo artist, but as a spiritual leader. He had no need to shout. He had only to speak. He had no need for excess. He had only to channel. And that's exactly what he did. In interviews, his demeanor was composed, eyes half-lidded, his words laced with poetic sharpness. When asked about the meaning of the Blackheart Man, he didn't explain it in commercial terms. "Is not just an album," he once said. "Is a movement. Is a resistance. Is a redemption sound for people Babylon Tri-Fi Barry." He knew he was no longer just Bunny of the Wailers. He was the Blackheart Man, a figure feared by systems, misunderstood by masses, but revered by the righteous. And in becoming that, he didn't just create an album. He created a new chapter in the book of reggae. One written not in ink, but in fire, in blood, and in divine word. Chapter 8, The Prophet Speaks. There are voices that entertain, and then there are voices that pierce the veil, cutting through the illusion of comfort, challenging every lie we were taught to believe. By the late 1970s, Bunny Wailer's voice had evolved into the latter. No longer merely a vocalist. No longer just a member of a legendary trio. Bunny had become something rarer, a prophet. He was not the type to flood interviews or chase soundbites. He did not need to dominate headlines or provoke with antics. His presence was quiet but commanding, like a priest walking into a room of lost men. People leaned in when Bunny spoke, not because he demanded it, but because truth has its own gravity. He didn't talk often, but when he did, you felt it. It started with his lyrics. Even after Blackheart Man, Bunny continued crafting albums that functioned more like spiritual texts than commercial records. Albums like Protest, Struggle, and Rock, and Groove were not just collections of songs. They were sermons wrapped in rhythm, each one a meditation on injustice, corruption, spiritual warfare, and redemption. He understood the power of music. But more than that, he understood the responsibility of music. "Music is a weapon," he once said during a rare press gathering. "Is either you play it to uplift or you play it to distract. But every man who hold microphone hold a sword." And Bunny wielded his sword with surgical precision. In public appearances, he began to speak more boldly about issues that others in the industry avoided. He criticized the Jamaican government for its neglect of the poor, its targeting of Rastas, and its failure to honor the country's African heritage. He spoke about colonialism, not just as history, but as ongoing violence, cloaked in education systems, economic policies, and imported religions. He didn't speak to please. He spoke to purge. When asked about the rising popularity of dancehall, he didn't mince words. While acknowledging the genre's talent, he decried its growing emphasis on slackness, materialism, and vanity. For Bunny, music had to serve a higher purpose. It had to educate, liberate, elevate. Reggae is church, he told one interviewer in the mid-80s. Dancehall is nightclub. Choose your temple. But it wasn't just music Bunny scrutinized, it was the world itself. He was deeply concerned with the degradation of Jamaican society. The surge in gun violence, the rise of garrison politics, the erosion of family values. He traced these ills not just to bad leadership, but to spiritual disconnect. People had turned away from the drum, from the soil, from Rastafari, and so he made it his mission to remind them. He could often be found at grassroots gatherings, Nyabingi ceremonies, and Rasta reasoning circles, speaking not as a celebrity, but as a vessel. Dressed in long white robes or his signature Rasta trench coats, he looked like a biblical figure stepping out of the scriptures. Dreadlocks flowing, eyes burning with ancestral memory. He didn't rely on notes. He didn't need them. When Bunny spoke, the words flowed like water from a mountain spring. Natural. Timeless. He quoted Haile Selassie, Marcus Garvey, and Psalms with the same ease that others quoted pop lyrics. But he wasn't all fire and brimstone. Bunny also brought love. He was at his core a healer. His critiques were never for destruction. They were for correction. His voice, though stern, carried a deep tenderness, a sorrow for what had been lost, a hope for what could still be found. He often spoke of Africa not as a symbol, but as a mother. His longing for repatriation was not about politics, it was about soul, about returning to source, to origin, to the rhythm that lived in every heartbeat, every bassline, every ancestral whisper. His spiritual beliefs remained the bedrock of everything he did. He rose with the sun. He practiced Ital living, no salt, no processed food, no chemical medicine. He kept the Sabbath. He fasted. He prayed. He listened. And it was through this rigorous spiritual discipline that his voice carried so much weight. Because Bunny didn't speak ideas. He embodied them. He began to be referred to by many as the guardian of the roots. While Bob had become a global symbol, Bunny became the spiritual spine of reggae. The one who refused to bend. Refused to dilute. Refused to be bought. He was respected by elders, feared by politicians, and revered by youth looking for something real, something pure, something unbroken. And as the years passed, Bunny's voice, though heard less often, became more powerful. A single quote from him could ripple through the culture for weeks. He was no longer simply part of the conversation. He was the pulse beneath it. In one of his most stirring speeches, given in 1990 during a Rasta symposium in Kingston, Bunny stood before a crowd of thousands and said, "We not come here fi beg no stage. We come fi remind people say the drums still beat. The ancestors still cry. Babylon still lie. But Zion still rise." The crowd fell silent. Some wept. Others chanted. Bunny wasn't performing. He was prophesying. And in that moment, no one questioned who he was. Not Bunny of the Wailers. Not Bunny the solo artist. But Bunny Wailer, the voice of the mystic drum. The keeper of the fire. The one who didn't need to chase the spotlight, because the light lived inside him.